You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Tippin, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Kara Keeling and Scott Pollard about their new book, Tablelands, Food and Children's Literature, published June 2020 by University of Mississippi Press. Kara Keeling and Scott Pollard are professors of English at Christopher Newport University. Kara is director of the Childhood Studies minor and teaches courses in children's and young adult literature. Scott teaches courses in world literature and food and literature. And together, they've offered a number of articles on the subject and have also edited the essay collection Critical Approaches to Food and Children's Literature from Routledge. Kara and Scott, welcome to the show and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, let's start with some background. So tell us a little bit about yourselves and how you came to this intersection of literary and food studies. What drew you each to the study of food and literature? Kara, let's start with you.
Well, it seems appropriate to note here that this project started over a meal. We were discussing Marie Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are because I was teaching it in my children's literature class as we were talking over dinner one evening. And it occurred to us that another picture book that we had recently purchased for fun, Henrik Drescher's The Boy Who Rayed Around, offered an interesting counterexample of the ways children negotiate excessive desires, both for food and for power and agency. And so we were talking about that. Scott loved The Boy Who Ate Around, and it occurred to us that maybe there was a paper idea here.
And
Scott?
To step in, that what's interesting to me, what's been interesting to me is that it was supposed to be simply a conference paper that we were going to do. And that was it. That was supposed to be the end of the project. And two decades and plus later, there have been two books and a number of other, many articles that we have written out of this project.
Yeah, you both come from a literary studies background, though. So maybe what is it that appealed to you about the role of food in literature?
Well, partly it was just everywhere that everywhere, once we began thinking about it, everywhere we looked, there was food. And it clearly played significant roles, symbolic roles, and especially in terms of children's literature, we began seeing how it was frequently tied into the issue of child agency. And that seemed worth exploring in many different formats.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about your collaboration. You are married. You work together. You collaborate on research, writing, and a little bit in teaching as well. Are there particular interests or strengths that you each bring to the collaboration, Scott?
That's a really good question. That collaboration has changed over the years. It used to be that we would all get with the two of us would gather around one person's desktop computer, and we would hand the keyboard back and forth
wow.
to each other as we were thinking and coming up with ideas. And then technology changed again, and then we all could sit on a sofa together around one laptop, and we pass the laptop back and forth. And now with Google Docs, we can sit in next to one another, or we can sit in different rooms, or I can be at home and Kara can be at the office, and we can work remotely. That's been the most amazing thing about this decade plus kind of odyssey is the technological changes that have made working together much, much easier.
Yeah. And we've always worked simultaneously on everything we've written. It's not like one chapter gets farmed out to one of us and another chapter to another, that most of the time, most of the creation of this book, one of us was typing and the other one was talking and the other, or vice versa, that, or one of us would talk and the other would write and then would revise what had been said and then more revisions, but usually right on the spot with each other, not separated.
Yeah.
Which is what I think most people think of collaborated books. Oh, you take this chapter, I'll take that chapter. And that wasn't how we did this at all. Basically, my mother wanted to know which sentences were written by you, Kara, and I had to say, well, all of them and none of them.
For us, it really is a collaborative process. I also work with another colleague in the department, Margarita Marinova, on a comparative literature project. And we initially started kind of working around a computer, you know, a desktop computer. But as that project has gone on, it's over now, that we work very separately. And we will author different pieces of a chapter that we're writing together.
So. Yeah, Ed, that's fascinating. How does the material of this book kind of relate to the courses that you teach, or the other way around? Did the teaching reveal to you texts that would be good for this book project?
Oh, absolutely. A number of the texts I suggested were ones that I had come across while teaching and said, we should think about doing a chapter on this book or this series of books that the Vietnamese chapter on Thana Lai's Inside Out and Back Again, that was a book I was already teaching. One Crazy Summer was a book I was already teaching. Scott, I think, had taught Peter Rabbit, but that came actually after the paper we wrote on Peter Rabbit. So there was back and forth between them, but a lot of it came straight out of me teaching my children's and young adult literature courses.
Scott, how does food sort of play into the courses that you teach?
Whereas for me, it was our project together that then motivated me to create two, now three courses on food and literature. Mm-hmm. Some of which have used children's literature, some of which have not, most of which actually have not. And so it was really the project that motivated me to kind of change what I teach. So that's been an interesting thing too. I taught a course on corn and literature for a freshman seminar. I'm teaching this course on food and literature as a sophomore seminar. And then I've taught for many years our senior seminar in the department on food and literature, which has everything from the Odyssey to Peter Rabbit in it.
That's exciting. So this channel, we often focus on books that are cultural histories of foods. Those seem to be really kind of popular in sort of publishing right at the moment. But literary food studies, that's sort of my home as well. And it's a little bit different. So maybe tell us a little bit about what you think, how you define literary food studies, or whatever term you use for this intersection of food and literary studies. What do you think they bring together that maybe they can't do apart? And Scott, I'll turn this question to you.
That's a really good question. That's a really complex and hard question. I think what they bring together is that literature is this kind of wonderful illustration of the significance of food in culture. That you can turn, as Kara already said, to any literary text practically, and find, if not a little bit of food, more often than not, a lot of food. And once you begin looking at food as a cultural signifier, you see the richness of the food, not only as a literary signifier, but also as kind of moving out into the culture and seeing how food is used by the culture and how the culture uses food to create meaning. That's kind of the simple answer to that question.
Yeah. Kara, is there something specific about children's literature that maybe brings additional attention to food and culture? Why do you think texts for children devote so much attention to food and foodways?
I think there's a lot of reasons for that. Part of it is that children's literature is written by adults, and it's the basic job of adults to feed children. That anybody who has spent any time with a kid knows that you've got to feed the child. And so their food is this constant presence within child rearing, within children's lives. It's a sensuous pleasure that they enjoy from early childhood onwards. It's a way of expressing individuality. I like this. I don't like that. Mom and Dad want me to eat this. I don't want to eat that. It's a way of getting attention. If I don't eat this, Mom and Dad are going to pay attention trying to get me to eat it. It's a it's a way of socializing. Children socialize over food just as adults do in the lunchroom, at school, snacks together after school. It is this constant presence in children's lives. So it gets reflected in the literature that it's a way of showing the autonomy of that children accrue as they get older. It's a way of showing how children are socialized into proper behaviors, because manners at the table are one of the central ways in which we socialize children. Manners may differ from culture to culture, but there are always manners centered around the table. The table is the place where children learn to be properly mannered social beings.
Can you bring this up in the introduction a little bit too, that children's literature is sort of by nature instructional, or is intended to be instructive in some ways. And that, for instance, in the next chapter about cookbooks, these are instructional texts as well. Is there something maybe about that instructional nature that makes food and children's literature a good pair?
Yeah, this goes back to the 18th century and the beginnings of children's literature in Britain, at any rate, that John Newbery, for whom the Newbery Award is named, advertised his first children's books as intended to delight and instruct. And that sense of instruction has always been there, that by reading, children learn about the world. And so by reading, they're going to learn about how to be human, how to be a proper person. I'm not expressing this very well.
No, I understand, right? Like how to be a fully formed contributing member of the family, of the culture that you find yourself in too.
Yes.
Yeah. Scott, I'll turn this one to you first. In the introduction, you talk about how you're revisiting some texts or revisiting some ideas that you've written about before, right, with a little bit of a new perspective. So talk a little bit about those changes. What's changed in your thinking between your last book and this one?
Actually, let me go back a bit further to our first articles. Mm-hmm. When we started, we very much kind of saw food as simply kind of having a symbolic importance. So it functioned as a literary symbol. Whether we were talking about Sendak or Drescher or Peter Rabbit, it was always about food as a literary symbol. We didn't we kind of moved into the margins of looking at it as a cultural product, as a social product, but mostly as a literary symbol. Then when we in 2008, when we published the collection, the kind of amazing moment there for us was that all of these writers who were writing about food brought so many different perspectives to their works and their topics. And suddenly the whole notion of food as simply a literary symbol kind of went out the window. And we spent the last decade, more than that now, kind of exploring the amazing complexity of food as a cultural, social, and historical object in which literary symbolism is just one piece of a larger complex of meanings. And what one of the results of that is that, that initially our research was pretty simple and straightforward. We were just looking at literary research.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, with this last book, we were researching in all sorts of fields in the last decade, all sorts mm-hmm. of fields in all sorts of ways. History, philosophy, sociology. It was amazing. As well as food studies. It was amazing. It was the complexity of the research just, you know, trebled.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an interdisciplinarity that necessarily occurs when you start thinking about food in this way.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kara, would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, the research wound up taking us places we had never really expected to go, that we had to learn so much about so many different cultural backgrounds, just to start with. You know, the final chapter on Fennel Lies, Inside Out and Back Again, we had to look up immigration studies and refugee studies and Vietnamese studies and Vietnamese diaspora studies and just so many intersections of different approaches, all the having bearing on foods and manners and how it's consumed and what it means. It's just an extraordinarily stimulating process.
Well, and that's a good kind of segue to my next question, which is about sort of the diversity of primary texts that you're interested in. So not only are we intersecting in these secondary fields, but the texts that you've chosen, some of them are very familiar, like Winnie the Pooh, Peter Rabbit, Little House on the Prairie, Disney's Ratatouille. But you also introduced me to some texts that were very new to me, like the Weetsy Bat series and Alice Waters' cookbook or books with her daughter, Fanny. These I didn't really know that those existed. So talk a little bit about the primary texts that you chose and what do you think brings them together? Kara, how about you take that one first?
Well, we wanted Tablelands to be a broad survey. It can't be exhaustive. That's just impossible. There's too much children's literature out there, too much food in it. So we wanted to try to be representative in a number of ways and expansive at the same time. So we organized the chapters in chronological order, more or less. We started with a chapter on cookbooks that actually does span a long period of time, but then the subsequent chapters are based on particular writers, and those are organized in roughly chronological order. And so we wanted to look at the Anglo-American tradition of children's literature, but we also wanted to show how that has expanded in diversity over the decades. And so we've got representations of Native American, Jewish American, African American, immigrant Vietnamese cultures. We've got regionalism. We also mm-hmm. wanted to try to have a variety of genres. So we have realism and fantasy and cookbooks and picture books and chapter books and young adult novels and film. And all of this is designed to show the comprehensive nature of the topic. It's everywhere.
Yeah, the first chapter interested me most, partly because of my own interest in the study of cookbooks as rhetorical and literary texts. So you look at three eras of cookbooks there that are aimed specifically at children as the audience who are learning to cook. Talk about some of the conclusions you came to in that chapter, Kara. What did you discover about this unique subgenre of cookbooks?
We were really interested to see how they changed over time. So we looked at cookbooks from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And the technology of cooking was very different back then, particularly that 19th century textbook, when you have stoves that are wood-fired and the children had to learn literally how to cook with fire and how to deal with heat sources that weren't even. That makes a tremendous difference when you're cooking bread, for instance. And so there were very substantial skills involved, and we had cookbooks about girls learning these at relatively young ages and writing their own recipe books, writing down the recipes as they got them. So the children were very active. They had a large part in it. Autonomy is often stressed in these early cookbooks, that the children want to learn how to cook without mother's help. They want to become cooks in their own right. And then in the mid-century, we saw how children's cookbooks reflected a larger shift in American cooking for adults, as well as industrialized foods, prepackaged foods, mixes, frozen foods, all these things came on, things that were designed to be labor-saving in the kitchen, but wind up meaning that kids don't actually learn how to cook for themselves. They tend to model cooking as play rather than as cooking as household help. And then we're finding in the late 20th, early 21st century, a shift back to children's autonomy, particularly in the work of Alice Waters and Molly Katzen, and books that want to develop genuine skills in children. Although also always with the proviso that parents are watching to make sure that children are safe.
Yeah, I was really interested in those mid-20th century cookbooks, that they never really seemed to live up to our expectations about good food. I think both the adult cookbooks that are full of Jell-O and the children's that are just easy bake ovens, right? You argue pretty convincingly to me in this middle period that cookbooks take agency away from children, and it just sort of makes their life this unserious play instead of welcoming them into part of the community and the family. That was surprising to me, that focus on pleasure might be detrimental to their self-efficacy. So, Scott, I would love to hear your kind of maybe explain that a little bit better for our readers, and what's sort of the argument behind that.
There are two kind of trends in the post-war period. One is that sense of disempowerment, that people can make food out of boxes and frozen boxes and cans, and don't need the kitchen skills anymore. And that's in the adult cookbooks as well as in the children's cookbooks. But there's also, I mean, this is when Julia Child is learning French cooking in France, and she comes back and in the early 60s begins, her PBS show. And so there is another trend there that tries to maintain the skills and power of cooking. So it's a difficult period, because on the one hand, yes, the cooking skills are maintained in some ways, but corporate America wants to kind of take those skills away at the same time. So it's a hard one to kind of navigate.
Yeah, and I think our sort of initial instinct is that children should play and children should experience food as pleasure, but maybe not in this particular way, that it's kind of a disempowering play.
Except for the book on boys cooking that we talked about.
Right.
Which is about a family of men because the mother has passed away, and then the father and the boys, you know, learn how to cook, and he teaches them how to cook in the house and outside the house, and it has a different feel to it because it is about empowerment. Rather than the other cookbooks we were looking at, which really aren't. It's really about kind of simple play.
Yeah. The next chapter introduces a conflict that permeates children's literature and comes up often in the book, and that is human-like animals who are looking for food or who are in danger of being eaten, either by people or by other animals. And your argument in that chapter is that Beatrix Potter's tales, including that very familiar Peter Rabbit, are really about these class tensions or the role of food in symbolizing class status in the real adult world, that historical world of English society. So Scott, tell us a little bit more about that. What are some of those markers of class status and civility in those stories? And what's significant about having animals play those roles?
Well, the simple answer to that last question is that the animals kind of stand in for the children. So the Beatrix Potter's audience as children see the animals as themselves. In terms of class, there's again, it's always a really complex question. You have characters that in Samuel Whiskers and the Roly-Poly Pudding that we talked about that are kind of living in the walls and between floors and don't have access to cooking skills. They have cooking skills, but don't have access to kitchens and such. And so they have to steal their way, you know, into the other animals' kitchen in order to be able to make a pudding. They aspire to be middle class, but they don't have the means, let's say it that way. And at the end of Sammy Whiskers, you know, Sammy Whiskers and his wife don't get what they want. They don't get to eat Tom Kitten as a pudding, which is just as well. But what we discovered is that there was all this research out there, it's social work research, that looked at how sociologists were trying to serve the poorer class of Londoners who were working in factories and living in awful conditions. And that there was an interesting parallel between kind of how social workers in London were trying to deal with how these poor folks ate and how a character like Samuel Whiskers and his wife were trying to eat.
And so the fictional characters were sort of embodying those lessons.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, when we were doing the research, we had no idea that we were going to encounter that there was work out there in social work theory and in sociology, and in historical work on sociology that talked about poverty in London and how social work and sociology kind of, or sociologists were trying to deal with poverty in London. So, but that's how we have the class markers.
All right, so another group of human-like animals who are navigating society appear in the next chapter on Winnie the Pooh. There you argue that food plays an important role in forming community and that Pooh's constant search for food and companionship in poetry motivates most of the plot of the books. So, Kara, how does Honey help Pooh find his identity as a poet?
Well, Pooh is famous for his desire for honey, for the sweet, for his insatiable desire to eat. But we noticed that his arc usually took him out of his home, and the search for food often involved his composition of poetry, and that he goes to his friends to eat with them, and that is often what inspires his poetry as well. That he composes his big epic poems at the climax of each story. And the banquets are places where he does that.
Yeah, so food, companionship, poetry, these are all really deeply intertwined and almost the same thing.
Yes, their pleasures. And one of the ways we put it in this chapter was that poetry and food are both pleasures of the mouth. Mm-hmm. And that the pleasure, the stimulation of eating leads to the pleasure of the poetry as well.
Mm-hmm. And if I can step in.
Please.
What's interesting here for me is that Pooh begins wanting to be the hero. Right? He wants to be the hero of the epic tale. But it's through the honey and the poetry that he discovers his role as poet. Finally giving over the hero role to Piglet, which he's had to struggle with because he wants to be the hero, but he can't be both the hero and the poet. He can be the bard, and that's kind of what he learns over the course of the two books. He learns to be the bard, and honey is central to that learning process.
Yeah, and again, that feast is the central place where the bard does his work.
Yes.
Right.
The Pooh is just like in the Odyssey. That's my thesis for the coming semester for my class.
That's great.
Just like the Odyssey.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, the next chapter turns to more realistic fiction, and this time a series of novels from Laura Ingalls Wilder and then Louise Erdrich. The Little House on the Prairie books tell one story of white pioneers and settlers who are repeating their Euro-American foodways in the West. But you argue that Erdrich's Birch Bark series is purposefully talking back to those books, reinscribing indigenous foodways into that place, the American West. So tell us a little bit about those key differences in those contrasting foodways, maybe Scott. And then, Kara, what you think is the significance of that counter-narrative?
Well, there are two very different sets of foodways, right? One is European based, and that's what the Ingalls family takes with them in their pioneering out to the West. Part of Manifest Destiny, part of the idea that it is the European settlers east that move west that make, you know, American civilization possible. And so everything kind of connects back to European foodways, European styles of cooking, repeating European foodways and styles of cooking. And what we get with Erdrich is, in a sense, the exact opposite, right? What she tries to do, and what's really fascinating in the research is that the new research that's out there on Native American cuisines and such, is that she tries to show how the Lakota are and how her family, I'm forgetting the name of the main character, how they kind of work from the land through their own cooking techniques to kind of claim their place in the land. And that's the fundamental difference, that one is importing a cooking tradition from Europe, and the other is grounding their cooking tradition in the land. And so that by the end of the still yet unfinished series by Erdrich, they are in a place where their initial, how can I say it? Their initial set of cooking skills and abilities are no longer applicable because they've gone from lake and forest to plains. So they're having to relearn kind of how to cook and how to think about themselves as cooking people.
Yeah, Kara, what's some of that evidence of counter-narrative, of that purposeful intertextuality? And what do you think is the significance of having that separate narrative?
Well, part of what the Ingalls family does is, especially when they move out onto the plains, is they transform the environment that they live in. In the big woods, they chop down the trees. In the in Kansas and Minnesota and South Dakota, they break sod. They transform the prairie for agricultural purposes, and they consider it's made clear in the mouths of the most racist character in Little House on the Prairie that the European Americans tend to think that the only purpose for the land is for agriculture. And they don't see the ways that the Indians use the land as actual land use. That's partly why they can't understand the kinds of communal land practices that the Native Americans have, that you've got completely fundamental clashes in ways of thinking and ways of understanding the land and land use. And the Ojibwa have lived in their part of Minnesota, southern Canada, around Lake Superior for generations, and they have learned how to use what the land provides and to follow its seasons. And they have, we focus in our discussion about particular cultivation and gathering practices of wild rice, maple syrup, berrying, and how those are seasonally tied and how they affect the way the family organizes its activities throughout the year. And the European method is much more about dominating the land and making it do what the European family, the Ingalls, wants it to do. They don't succeed very well a lot of the time. It's so much more of a struggle for the Ingalls family to try to make their living from the land than it is for the Ojibwa family. I don't mean that it's not difficult for them, but they have a much deeper understanding. And one of the ways we end that chapter is discussing how food sovereignty is still a major Ojibwa and as well as other tribal nations argument, that they want to have the food sovereignty. They want to be able to hunt and gather, particularly gather in ways that their ancestral peoples did, that's fundamental to cultural identity.
Yeah. And interestingly, taking that the children as the audience and that idea of instructive, the nature of the genre, if Little House on the Prairie is the only narrative that stands in children's literature, then we can't move forward on those issues, perhaps.
And there's just no other way of thinking about them, because that's the way that the Ingalls family did it, so that's the right way. And Wilder is a wildly popular novelist that people still read her books. Girls dress up as Laura Ingalls does in the books. They want to recreate the kinds of things that young Laura does. There's a Laura Ingalls Wilder cookbook so that young girls and primarily girls, boys too, but primarily girls can learn to cook the sorts of dishes that are out there. And I think that Erdrich really wants to talk back to that. She says that explicitly in some interviews that we quote, that she enjoyed the Wilder books, but what she loved was the sausages, and that she wanted to capture that kind of domestic joy in eating together, that and making food that the that Wilder's books capture so well.
Yeah, Scott, was there something you wanted to add?
I just wanted to add that one of the things we discovered as we were doing the research, and this is how we ended this chapter, is that there's also right now this really kind of fascinating renaissance in Native American cuisines. There's this amazing cook called by Sean Sherman called The Sous Chef, which is a great title for a cookbook.
The pun is magnificent.
The pun is magnificent, yes. And it's very much a kind of gathering kind of cookbook. I've tried cooking out of it a few times, but it really does require you to go out into the world and forage around and find things. But this is a kind of cooking that's become a cooking style that's not European, that is becoming important in the United States. It was interesting that as our work on Erdrich, developed, that we found this interesting parallel to how Native American cuisines are developing and growing right now.
Yeah, the book really looks at a wide variety of genres. We've already sort of alluded to that, including the next chapter, which is about Maurice Sendak's picture book, In the Night Kitchen. So in this chapter, you decode some of the biographical clues that are in the artwork to discuss some of the less obvious ways that Sendak is exploring 1930s Jewish food waves and enclaves in Brooklyn, especially the emphasis on baking. So what are some of the most interesting details that might not be immediately apparent to casual readers who might be familiar with In the Night Kitchen? Kara, I'll turn that over to you.
Well, one of the things that struck us was the cityscape that is made out of food. And we eventually linked this up with programmatic architecture in the United States. You know, those restaurants that sell hot dogs that are shaped like hot dogs, or one that is near my parents' house in Florida that is an ice cream store that's shaped like an ice cream cone. And Sendak uses the kitchen implements and foods that he remembers from his childhood as a child in New York City in Brooklyn in the 1930s, and turns them into this magnificent kind of dreamscape. But I think one of the reasons we buy into it is that we know buildings that look like food and that are used as ways of attracting people to eat food. And that was just not something I'd ever really thought about until we started researching the book. But there's also, Sendak has given a lot of interviews about his work and particularly about Night Kitchen and how he sees it as an homage to the wonderful foods of his childhood. And he remembered going from Brooklyn into Manhattan, which was this place of incredibly exotic foods for him. Exotic foods that were, in fact, actually very American foods, but very different from the Jewish household in which he was growing up. And he discusses his memories of the World's Fair and the bakers that he saw. He had this very particular memory of standing and waving to the bakers in one section of the fair, and those are the ones that find their way into the three bakers of In the Night Kitchen.
Yeah, so again, more evidence of this diversity in the book. After that picture book that's focusing on a very young child, the next chapter is a trilogy of novels that, again, were new to me, the Wheatsey Bat novels, dramatically different, right? From 1930s Brooklyn to punk rock LA, the audience seems more mature. The themes seem more mature, maybe an older adult, an older young adult audience. How does food establish a sense of place and identity in those novels, Scott?
Well, Francesca Lea Block kind of uses food from the very beginning to the very end to help establish what it means to be in Los Angeles, in particular to be in Laurel Canyon and Hollywood. There is the food they eat at the house. There is the restaurants they go to visit when they leave the house. And what for me, what it does is kind of establish LA as this kind of really kind of fascinating kind of capital of food, which then we found in the research and in particular in the food writer Jonathan Gold, who unfortunately has passed on, and his explorations of LA food, and that what his work very much kind of seemed to coincide with her explorations of food in the Wheatsey Bat series. His explorations were all about discovering LA through the food, and the Wheatsey Bat series seems to be all about discovering LA through the food. And so that's the kind of the basics that we came to with that series. And you get and for me, because I'm from California and went to school in Southern California, it's very nostalgic. And it was for her too, because she wrote the first Wheatsey Bat, the first book, while she was at Berkeley, as this kind of love letter to LA, because she was so nostalgic for it. And it was through the food over and over again in the novels, in that novel and in the rest of them, that she kind of grounds her nostalgia.
Yeah, say a little bit more about the sort of countercultural vegetarian aspects of the food in the novel as well.
That is clearly kind of how she defines LA cuisine. It's not how Jonathan Gold defines LA cuisine, but it's how she defines it. And so when characters, if you will, go off the vegetarian vegan diet to eat meat, it's always a problem. They always lose themselves. In the last novel, when the main character is in New York, looking for herself, that she ends up eating meat and she has to be rescued. So it's always the vegan, the vegetarian, the macrobiotic foods which restore people's health and restore people's being and people's identity and characters' identity. Meat is always meat, and sweets are also bad. You know, high fructose corn syrup, Coke is also bad. But anything that is healthy and healthful and organic is very much about people discovering or characters discovering themselves in a good way.
Yeah. The next chapter on Ratatouille struck me as particularly an accessible entry point for undergraduate students to literary food studies. I teach a class on food and American identity, and I'm always looking for some sort of scholarship that will do the work of literary analysis through food studies that is something students already know, they're already familiar with, and then they can sort of really watch that academic and theoretical rigor applied to something that they know. So at 21 pages, that chapter is gold. I'm going to assign it as soon as I get back in fall.
Very good.
So, the central question of that chapter has to do with Remy the Rat's temporary and incomplete acceptance into the human world. So even though the movie seems to break down human and animal dichotomies, in the end, that separation of human and rats is really reinforced rather than undermined. So Kara, I'll start with you. What do you think is significant about that, sort of the ending, that ambivalence towards animals?
Well, I remember when I first watched the film, I actually had a a real reaction to rats in the kitchen. that I was essentially responding to the kind of vermin signifier that we discuss in the chapter. And then what became alarming as we began thinking about it was that at the end, the film seems to create this happy ending in which the rats have access to beautifully cooked food from Remy that he has found a place in the kitchen. And that, there is this sort of vision of community at the end. But then when you think about it, they're excluded. They're in the small bistro. They're excluded from the great hierarchical haute cuisine institution of French food. And more disturbingly, the rats themselves are kept separate from the other diners. That if we're supposed to be reading the rats as coming into equality with as Remy as finding his arc as chef, as hero, that winds up being subverted at the end. That yes, he does get to be a chef in this little restaurant, but and he gets to serve both his family and human customers. But the rats live in the attic, and they are separate from the humans. And there is a real question about how equal that makes them at the end of the book, or at the end of the film, I think.
Yeah. Scott, did you want to add something to that as well?
The one thing that I kept thinking about as we were talking about this, as we were writing about it, is that what the filmmakers do is create this kind of, if you will, a kind of bubble of intersectionality where the human and the rat can come together and it works for a little bit. But what they can't do is imagine beyond that bubble. The comparison that I make is to in Cervantes' Don Quixote, when Don Quixote is in the mountains in the first book, he encounters a woman who wants to be a shepherdess and does not want to be courted, does not want to marry any man. She has all these men who are chasing after her, you know, in the mountains. And she makes her case to them. They, of course, ignore her case. And she disappears to join the other shepherdesses deep in the mountains. And what Cervantes can't do at that moment is say, okay, I'm now going to, you know, take my narrative lens and look at this community of women, community of shepherdesses living off alone by themselves, fully capable of living off alone and by themselves with their sheep. Instead, he just kind of ends it. But she offers this kind of ideal setting of women off by themselves, living on their own as shepherdesses. But he can't quite imagine that. And that's what I think about the end of Ratatouille. The filmmakers want to imagine intersectionality between rats and humans, and they can conceive of it for a moment, but can't see it beyond that moment.
And if we're supposed to see the rats as representing the outsider, the other, then what does this mean at the end of the film when the rats and the other remain otherized, remain separated, remain segregated?
Yeah, and I think I remember in that chapter you talk about how often rats and mice are the main characters of children's, you know, literature, mm-hmm. and we're sort of meant to identify ourselves as children with the mice. But it definitely doesn't finish. It doesn't finish working in this metaphor here.
No.
Yeah. So can I ask you one more question about animals, right? Taken together, there's so many of these texts that analyze that human and children's relationship to animals. The next chapter, which we'll talk about in a minute, again, operates on tensions around milk and eggs and a character who eschews meat. So before we get there, like, what do you think are some of those threads to draw together about animals and humanity and their relationship to and with each other? Scott, I'll let you take that one.
That it's always inevitably complex. that it'd be nice to simply say, all right, in children's literature, animals always represent children. And there's a simple narrative arc in which X, Y, and Z happens and everything ends up happily in the end. Instead, you know, what we saw in Beatrix Potter, what we see in Ratatouille, is that the relationships are amazingly complex and can't be kind of simply undone to create a happy ending. There's always going to be problems. There are always going to be difficulties. And so I think that's kind of one of the major lessons that you can take from kind of the animal-human kind of connection there, that it's not just simple cute animals, that connection is always going to produce a lot of really interesting thought and kind of complex issues to think through.
Yeah. The rest of that chapter on the trilogy of novels from Williams Garcia addresses the main character's journey to understanding this continuum of performances of womanhood, of motherhood, and blackness. And those are all kind of negotiated through food. It was a lot in this chapter, but yeah. For listeners, maybe start with that part, describing those three kind of place-based models of womanhood and the relationships that the main character absorbs across those three novels. Kara, I'll turn that one to you.
That was a really hard chapter to write because we eventually figured out that we had to talk about the books in the opposite order, that it's a trilogy and we start with the last book and then move to the middle book and then move to the first book. But this is partly because the food ways in the books, the main character, as she ages, she seems to go back into time from the most radical moment where she's located at the beginning of the first or in the first book through other stages. So we wound up talking about the third of the novels, What Gone Crazy in Alabama First, because it represents the Southern food ways that her grandmother has instilled in her and the appreciation for slow cooking, for the foods that are based in the land that come right off the farm, and with all the kinds of tensions in that novel that reflect the place that African Americans had in the American South in the Jim Crow era. And then the older women, the great mentors in that book, are the ones who know the traditions that Delphine, the protagonist, is beginning to absorb as a young black girl coming into the early stages of young womanhood. And then the second novel, PSB 11, there is nowhere near as much food in that book, and we didn't spend as much time on it. But what there is seems to suggest the kinds of urban foods of the post-war era that the girl's new stepmother is a cook who knows those industrialized foods, that's very different from what Delphine knows from her grandmother, who has gone back to the South. There's takeout food. They order pizzas. That it's a very convenience food based kind of cuisine. And then the first book, the final one we tackle in the chapter, is when the girls go to visit their mother in California, whom they have not seen for many years. And has been estranged. And she is involved with the Black Panthers, and her kitchen has been transformed from a place to make food into a place to make art. And Delphine brings food back into the kitchen that she cooks for her little sisters and for her mother, too. And her mother sends her to, and her sisters, to the Black Panthers every morning for breakfast. And we did a lot of research on the breakfast program that the Panthers started. And that's not what a lot of people think of when they think of the Black Panthers, but it is, in fact, one of their most important and enduring legacies. Scott, did you want to add anything?
What I would add to that is that, again, food is a measure of empowerment, that in the third novel, which is all about, you know, African-American Southern foodways, food is a very powerful kind of cultural, not just symbol, but powerful economically for the family. And yet in the first novel, where all those traditions have been lost, because now this is urban food, urban fast food, urban convenience food in Oakland, that the Black Panthers still are using food as a means of empowerment to feed children and give them the fuel they need for the rest of the day so that they can do better in school. One of the things the Black Panthers did with that breakfast program is basically get the city's school districts in California, and then I think across the nation, into offering breakfast programs for students to give them the fuel that they need to make it through the day. So it's interesting whether you're talking about, you know, the food in the Deep South, or food in New York, or food in Oakland, and they're very different kinds of food. And yet Rita Williams Garcia always uses food here as a means of empowerment.
Yeah, and they're not necessarily like vilified against one another, right? No. They all kind of come out value neutral. Yeah,
exactly.
The final chapter examines the story of a family of Vietnamese refugees in America. And you suggest that the author, Tana Lai, is like Erdrich writing against this established representation of refugee experiences, especially those written by non-Vietnamese authors for non-Vietnamese audiences. So Scott, how does Lai's book revise and refute what you call the gratitude narrative that's expected of refugees?
Basically, again, this is the issue of empowerment. And what we see is that as the family moves from Vietnam to Thailand, what about the Philippines? I forget. Sorry. To the U.S. and into Alabama, is that they find ways in which to establish their own culture again and again through food. That rather than simply capitulating and being grateful for American chicken, which tastes like rubber and it has the texture of rubber, they figure out ways in which they can remake, reappropriate, rethink Vietnamese cuisine within an American context. And when we were doing the research into Vietnamese American cookbook authors, that's exactly kind of how they talked about coming to the United States, being grateful for being saved from death and destruction, but then using this space in the U.S. to rethink, reappropriate, and make Vietnamese identity and food a fundamental part of how they became American. I'll say it that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I'll add that one of the things I love about the book is how it defamiliarizes American food through the protagonist's eyes. We see how incredibly strange it is to her. And I think that that's something that could have a powerful effect on children reading the book who take their own cuisine for granted, and to see that it is not ordinary, it is not usual, it's not standard to other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so kind of to wrap up, what do you think are the most important takeaways from this project, Kara?
I think a lot of it comes down to what Scott was saying, that food and children's literature is very much about empowerment and agency and autonomy and ways of gaining that for protagonists who are looking to become more powerful. Children live in a disempowered state most of their lives, that they are dependent and reliant. And children's literature in general is a kind of dream of autonomy. and that food becomes a way of enabling that, of creating that for themselves in many cases.
Yeah, Scott, what do you think?
The issue for me is that we go back to our initial conversation that perhaps we can look at cookbooks as simply being instructional, or we could look at children's literature as simply being instructional. But, you know, what we've discovered through our research is that's and all these readings is that it's not. That it is really explorational. It is really about empowerment. It's about saying, where am I in the world and how do I find a place in it? And okay, so there's food over here and I can use food in these really interesting ways to make my stake in the world. And whether that's, you know, even the 19th century cookbooks where it is instructional, but these children find power through that instruction, or go back to the Alice Waters and Molly Katzen cookbooks. It's about how kids use food to find themselves and find their position and place in the world. And I think that's what everything we looked at in this book is about that.
Yeah, well said. What project are you working on next, Kara?
Well, Scott and I have just finished another joint project, although not on food. It is on children's literature. It's on disability and the Velveteen Rabbit for a centenary study on the Velveteen Rabbit. And I'll let Scott say a bit more about that, and then we can each talk about our independent projects.
Yeah, please.
I've done on and off for a couple of decades scholarship on disability studies, and it's mostly been off rather than on. but I edited a special anthology of the Children's Literature Association Quarterly in 2013 on disability studies in children's literature. And our friend Lisa Rofrastina, who is editing this volume, was looking at her contributors and thought that she needed a disability studies approach for the Velveteen Rabbit. And so I spent a lot of time since the shutdown, rereading and reacquainting myself with disability studies scholarship. And that's been a really kind of interesting process because it's been a while since I've read any of it. It's always a learning process for me. I was trained as a Latin Americanist and a comparatist, and then found my way with Kara into children's literature, and it's always for me a learning process. This process of discovery, and so when we got this offer to do this disability studies project, I said sure, and have kind of loved the results. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, how about those independent projects, Kara?
I'm working currently on a project on two young adult novels and using Kristeva to discuss abjection within them. So instead of looking at what goes into the body, I'm going to be looking at what comes out.
Oh, that's exciting. I have a side interest in vomit as well. I always bring that up to my student in exactly that way, and it always gets a really good laugh. Yeah. That's great. Scott, what else is working? What else are you working on?
I have another project that I've worked on for a while is on Don Quixote. With my colleague, Margarita Marinova, she did a translation of a Russian version of Don Quixote by the novelist Mikhail Bulgakov. And that got us in contact with a Spanish professor at Marshall University who is also Russian and wanted us to do some work for him. And so we've done some work for him, and he's really amazingly productive. and so he contacted us again at the beginning of this year because he's got another book project on international versions of Don Quixote. And so Margarita's writing one thing for him, and I've decided to write, to go back to an earlier project that I began in the late 90s on 18th century English versions of Don Quixote.
Wow. That's great.
Children's versions.
Aren't they the children's versions of Don Quixote?
Sorry, they are the children's versions of Don Quixote.
Oh, that's great. Okay, good. Full circle. Well, today we've been talking with Kara Keeling and Scott Pollard about their new book, Tablelands, Food and Children's Literature, published June 2020 by University of Mississippi Press. Kara and Scott, it has been an absolute delight talking to you today. Thank you for being with us.
It's been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.